Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be looking at the recent U.S. Precision strike in Somalia and Trump's counterterrorism policy in Africa. I'm joined by two special guests, Professor Colin Clark and Lucas Weber. Professor Clark is senior research fellow and director of research at the SOFIN Group and SOFIN Center. His research focuses on domestic and transnational terrorism, international security, and geopolitics. He has previously worked as professor at Carnegie Mellon University and a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. And Lucas Weber is also a research fellow at the SOFIN Center, where he looks at domestic terrorism, extremist propaganda, financing, and use of technology, violent non-state actors in South and Central Asia, and armed group adaptation to the emerging multipolar order. He is the co-founder of the Militant Research Network, an organization that provides in-depth analysis of the propaganda and operations of armed groups worldwide. Gentlemen, I'm pleased to have you join me today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Brilliant. So let's start off. I think it was kind of very surprising to me, maybe to other people, the recent U.S. precision attack on ISIS in Somalia. And this is based on, we recently had an episode where we were looking at what Trump's second presidency holds. And one of the things that people that came up from that episode is Trump would not prioritize Africa. So to see Trump order this, so this seems more to be very surprising. How do you explain this?
Yeah, I think, you know, I might push back a little bit on the notion that Trump wouldn't prioritize Africa. I think, you know, potentially as a whole, it could rank lower on the foreign policy priority list. I mean, obviously, the first head of state to visit was Benjamin Netanyahu from Israel. The Gaza conflict looms large. The relationship between the United States, Israel, and what to do about Iran looms large. Russia, Ukraine as well. But there's been, you know, murmurings that Trump is going to appoint Peter Pham as a special envoy. He was a special envoy to the Great Lakes during Trump's first administration, really knowledgeable on African policy, someone that cares a lot about Africa. And so I expect him to be quite active. But there's also looming in the background of this, the potential withdrawal of U.S. troops from Somalia. Just this week, in fact, yesterday, we heard more talk about orders, the Pentagon ordering U.S. troops to withdraw potentially from Syria. Somalia could be next. And I think, you know, I was quoted in a New York Times article by Eric Schmidt on the Somalia strikes as saying, if Trump is going to pull troops out of Somalia, he's going to kind of look for some muscular actions first as a prelude before doing that, in a way to kind of emphasize that the U.S. can still contain the threat even without a presence, although personally I think that's a bad idea.
Oh, thanks for the pushback, and I know Peter Pham's work, he's very solid, so I do see your point there. Lucas, do you agree with Colin's take on this, or do you have a different opinion?
Yes. Well, what we're seeing very early is a fast and aggressive move to consolidate U.S. security policy. So what we're likely seeing is a reduction in terms of the number of security issues they want to put primary focus on, and a kind of consolidation on a few different security issues. This one kind of, the sense we get is that it starts at the U.S. homeland and works out. And Somalia is interesting because the group we'll be discussing today, the Islamic State branch in Somalia, has been showing signs, particularly over the last 3 years, of trends of internationalization. The transnational threat from this branch is quite peculiar. We see that as the Islamic State kind of integrates its leadership structure globally, IS Somalia has been given increased authority in the global and regional operational structure. And we've seen these networks really expand from this branch into Europe, into North America. When we look at plots, foiled plots, and foreign fighters who attempted to travel to this branch. So overall, this branch will receive a notable amount of attention. I think we see that early with these strikes. This is making a point that they are emphasizing, and they are aware of the potential threat, the growing threat that this branch in particular poses to international security.
I want to follow up on what Colin said about his assessment of the strategy. You did say you think personally it's a bad move. And I'm thinking maybe it's more a statement. So if you look at what's happened in the Sahel, how the anti-French and also generally the anti-Western narratives, and how you know, the U.S. troops and French troops have been asked to leave that place. Do you think this is more? And I've been looking at, we've been seeing the Western forces retreating from Africa, being asked, whereas other forces like China, mainly Russia, are taking some kind of. So, do you think this is a statement to counter that? To counter maybe China or Russia's, you know, influence, growing influence in Africa?
It's hard to say because, you know, I see a lot of kind of policies working at cross purposes, let's say. I'll give you an example. Cutting or withdrawing, reducing USAID to me is a sign that the administration doesn't fully understand great power competition, because how are we going to compete with Russia and China when we're withdrawing our military, when we're withdrawing our aid, right? This harkens back to kind of like Fortress America, almost neo-isolationist streak. And look, let's be clear. I don't think the United States should be in any more wars or any more conflicts, but there are certain parts of the world where we do have a military toehold, and that toehold in and of itself allows us to project influence, to project power, and it allows critical intelligence assets, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets that are crucial to continuing to fight against the Islamic State's global network. Lucas talked quite a bit about IS Somalia, which I think, you know, when you look at some of the other branches, ISIS-K in Afghanistan, right, gets a lot more attention these days, and for good reason. But ISIS Somalia actually is such a crucial logistical and facilitative node in the broader global network. You know, Lucas and Caleb Weiss had a really great piece on this in the CTC Sentinel a short while ago, and Aaron Zellin in War on the Rocks has done a masterful job at kind of laying out how the Islamic State's global network functions. And ISIS Somalia is a critical linchpin in that network. So, you know, this is a challenge that is not going away. And as we've seen elsewhere, and I think we're likely to learn it this coming year in Syria, you know, we can talk about all the factors and variables that contribute to a growth in terrorism, but geopolitics, which are inherently sometimes very difficult to predict, look at the fall of the Assad regime as an example, can impact what's happening on the battlefield. And there's a number of developments that I'll be watching closely this year that are likely to impact the terrorist threat in the Horn of Africa. One of them, and we can get into this if you'd like to at some point, is the potential recognition of Somaliland as an independent country and what that could do to geopolitics in the nation. And then I would just throw in there as well, you know, looking at some of the other groups active in Somalia, the growth of Al-Shabaab and potential Iranian sponsorship, as well as a growing relationship between Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Al-Shabaab and the Houthis as well. So a big hornet's nest of states and violent non-state actors in that part of the world.
I'm glad you mentioned all of this, and I'm glad you mentioned Somaliland, because one of our highest viewed episode is one on Somaliland recognition. So I'm going to come to that in a minute, but let me go to, let's zone in on ISIS Somalia. So we saw with the killing of the ISIS caliph, Abu Bakr Baghdadi, I think in 2019. So what we saw is the ISIS proxy, Africa became like more like the center. So ISIS center was, a lot of attention was in different proxies, different Islamic state proxies in Africa. So I wanted to look at, can you describe how Somalia, ISIS Somalia stands out compared to all of these other ISIS proxies in the different places in Africa?
ISIS Somalia has become a central hub. When we look at the Islamic State's Directorate of Provinces, for instance, it's ISIS Somalia has become the base, essentially the leadership of the regional IS kind of logistics operations network in the region. We've also seen that it's really risen as a global financial hub. It's even, as Colin mentioned earlier, with the increased threat from Islamic State Khorasan province in Afghanistan and Pakistan, IS Somalia, as reported by the UN monitoring team, they actually transferred something like $25,000 to the Islamic State Khorasan province. And we know that there's some involvement from, or some kind of support given from IS Somalia to the Islamic State in Afghanistan, Pakistan to help bolster its operations. We also see this across the African continent. So IS Somalia, its leadership, they've been given increased authority in the region and globally over recruitment, sending trainers to other conflict theaters, sending financial support, and all kinds of kind of logistical bolstering in the region and globally. So IS Somalia is, particularly over the last 3 years, a rising transnational threat to both U.S. interests and international security. So it definitely needs to be, there needs to be vigilance in terms of how to approach and address and contain and degrade IS Somalia. And this includes on the battlefield and online as well. Something we've seen, for instance, is that IS Somalia has a growing supporting propaganda apparatus that publishes news and religious instructions and all kinds of media content in a number of regional languages. And one, to wrap it up, one international kind of implication of this is that IS Somalia has been increasingly gaining traction with diaspora communities, segments within these communities abroad, whether it's in Europe or North America. So we received a wake-up call earlier in January that with the New Orleans attack, just how much of a threat the Islamic State poses to the U.S. homeland. And IS Somalia is really a growing presence or force in this sphere of transnational reach.
Collins, let me follow up on what Lucas said about the New Orleans attack. I'm looking at how ISIS in Somalia, and how much of a threat is it to the U.S. homeland?
Look, I think, you know, after the New Orleans attack, I kept getting the same question, which is, you know, are we at the beginning of a new wave here of homegrown violent extremist attacks inspired by the Islamic State? And my honest answer was, I don't know. I'm not a threat inflator. I'm not an alarmist. But I am somebody that takes this threat seriously. Folks like myself and Lucas, our colleague Clara Brokart, many others in this same space are constantly tracking and monitoring ISIS propaganda. And putting it in context, it remains a threat. I look at it as a constant, steady threat. And again, sometimes that ebbs and flows in response to geopolitics and in response to counterterrorism pressure. And I think that's one of my concerns is with the shift in resources away from counterterrorism toward great power competition, with what's happening in the United States now with cutting staff of the intelligence community, forcing people to retire, and what you might argue is the current administration, you know, really pressuring the intelligence community, the FBI, the CIA. That to me is very risky. It's myopic because what happens there, and we saw this last year in 2024 in Iran with the ISIS-K attack in January, with the ISIS-K attack in Moscow in March in Russia, both those intelligence services, right, the Russians and the Iranians, are busy persecuting political opponents, domestic political opponents, harassing LGBTQ folks, doing all sorts of things that are not counterterrorism related, and they were both hit. And that was with the benefit of a U.S. warning in both cases. I worry at home that we're going to be distracted with so many things that aren't counterterrorism related that it makes us even more vulnerable to getting hit on the homeland, because there's no shortage of groups, whether IS Somalia, IS, you know, Khorasan, and many others that are agitating and would love nothing more than to hit the United States on U.S. soil. And frankly, we're overdue. We've been blessed to have world-class intelligence services. But again, the enemy gets a vote. They're relentless. And we see that every day as we're monitoring their threats and growing capabilities, frankly.
Connie, let me stay with you for a minute. Talking about intelligence gathering, we're seeing also how, and I'll come back to Lucas to talk about the multipolar. We see how the world is shaping in terms of like the multipolarity of power formation or configuration. And then we see Trump coming to the equation and then see, you know, this withdrawal from, you know, different alliances and see the tension with, you know, with Europe and all of this. Do you think that it's going to affect having the kind of intelligence that we need to halt some of this, some kind of like the multinational, because it's a very transnational in nature. Do you think that's going to have an impact on addressing these threats in real time or, you know, before these threats happen? So I guess my question is, do you think these tensions can in a way adversely impact on the sharing of intelligence and all that could be, you know, instrumental to preventing many terrorist attack on
the
West?
Is this for me or for Lucas or for both?
For you, Colin, sorry.
Look, I think anytime you are distracted, you're bickering with allies, which we're doing. You know, we've been kind of antagonizing the Canadians. You know, we've been concerning the Europeans. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now, even within the United States, about what is the Trump doctrine, right? Other than make America great, which is a fairly ambiguous term. And, you know, there's a lot of pearl clutching over this. And I'm not somebody that, you know, is triggered by everything Trump does. I think every country advocates for their own national interest. But how do you translate that into effective foreign policy is the question. Let's put politics aside. And I think that's where my concern is that we're unnecessarily agitating our allies at a time when we should be united. There's a threat of Russian hybrid warfare. There's a continued threat of global jihad. And I think that's something that maybe bothers me, not just taking off my analyst hat for a second and just speaking as an American citizen. You know, when we were hit on 9/11, the government told us at the time that this would be a long war, that it would be a generational struggle. And I'm still of that mindset. A lot of people have moved on. People call it counterterrorism fatigue, right? As if this were a trend. And, you know, I'm over that now. I don't really want to think about that anymore. It's hard. It's uncomfortable. We're operating in a world of uncertainty, but I very much look at this as a generational issue, and it's one that I've dedicated my career to studying. And I am concerned, like many of my colleagues in the field, that we're not applying the proper level of resources to the threat, and that we're distracted both domestically, but also abroad, that our priorities aren't in the right place.
Look at them. Colin mentioned earlier, you mentioned Al-Shabaab. I mentioned other kind of threats, the Houthi rebels and all of that stuff. But, you know, we'll focus on ISIS, Somalia. But how about Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda networks? Do you think they also pose... whilst we're focused on ISIS, Somalia, do we kind of like take our eye off them, or do they? What kind of threats do they present? Lucas, we can't hear you. I think you're muted.
Sorry, Al-Shabaab is one of the most capable insurgent groups on the planet. It has a robust militant infrastructure. Robust online propaganda apparatus, has deep community roots, and also something we're seeing that ties into great power competition and kind of reminds us of the fact that you can't separate strategic competition, freedom of shipping movement, for instance, from these conflicts, as we've seen in the post-October 7th environment. The major actors gravitate towards conflicts in terms of power jockeying and so on. With Shabaab particularly, they've been involved in external operations before in Djibouti. They've done cross-border incursions into Kenya and so on. They have a robust international network. And something we've seen that has been very concerning is they seem to have been strengthening ties and logistical cross-strait channels and routes with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And AQAP, which is the Yemen-based branch, is probably the spearhead of Al-Qaeda external operations since the late 2000s. So there's a significant threat in terms of these groups linking up. AQAP and the Houthis, for instance, have done technology transfer, drone training, and so on to mutually benefit the organizations. And there are rumors that Shabaab is now being interlinked with the Houthis in certain aspects. There's not a great deal of information available on it, but this shows that the landscape's evolving all the time, and the transnational linkages and developments are quite dangerous and threaten, you know, on land interests, overseas trade and shipping, and so on. So it's important to contain these organizations, be vigilant towards them, and really take a smart approach in terms of countering them.
Yeah, brilliant, Colin. Let me come to what Luke is saying, and then link it to what you were saying before in terms of politics and geopolitics. And we look at in the Horn of Africa, so we see what's going on. So let's come to Somaliland that you mentioned before. So we've seen early last year, we saw the agreements between Ethiopia and Somaliland and the tension it brought in Somaliland. Recently, we've seen Erdogan's the agreement he facilitated between Ethiopia and Somalia. And then I'm glad Luke mentioned, you know, access to sea and all of this stuff and all of this kind of stuff. How do you think all of this play into the terrorist threat? And
yeah, look, I think, and this is where my sense is that the U.S. government, and this is not a partisan statement, I think this was true of the Biden administration. We'll see if it's true of Trump 2.0. But in general, the U.S. still doesn't fully understand great power competition. Because I hear, well, we're pulling out of, you know, name your place, right? Country, region. We're pulling out of the Sahel to focus on great power competition. We're reducing our footprint in the Horn of Africa to focus on great power competition. But that's where great power competition is happening, in those regions, in Central Asia and elsewhere. So I'm not sure we fully kind of grasp it. You know, just looking at East Africa alone is fascinating. You've got all these overlapping conflicts, potential conflicts. Sudan, you've got multiple players playing, in some cases, like the Russians, both sides of the conflict, right? With Wagner helping the RSF, but Putin looking to cut a deal with Burhan to get access to Port Sudan. And a lot of it's geopolitical related. The Somaliland deal about a port, right? The Ethiopians want maritime access, the potential for a naval base. You also have Gulf countries like the UAE acting behind the scenes in many of these conflicts. You have the GERD, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, and how players shake out there. And then you've got Somaliland, right? With, again, the Ethiopians supporting independence, the Turks backing Mogadishu. So this is all taking place kind of below the surface. And I think we often make a mistake when we talk about great power competition, and then we say the U.S., China, Russia. Well, there's more players involved, and it's happening at what we call the kind of middle power level, right? Or that second order, you know, Turkey, the BRICS countries,
UAE,
the Horn. That level of analysis too often gets neglected, but that's where the real moves are being made, in my opinion. I just want to hone in real quickly to answer your question on the CT part of this. I'm very concerned about how Iran moves forward, because the Iranians are arguably weaker than they've ever been. The axis of resistance has been attenuated significantly, particularly Lebanese Hezbollah, which is kind of the tripwire in the region. So weak and desperate countries often, you know, take desperate measures. And I'm concerned, I tweeted about this the other day, that this year could bring an increase in state-sponsored terrorism, including with not the usual suspects. And so I would be curious to watch the relationship between Iran and al-Shabaab in Somalia. Again, if the Somaliland independence goes forward, you're going to see countries kind of jockeying for position and looking to support their respective proxies to gain advantage in the region. So a lot going on. I think we're in for a sporty year in 2025 for those to follow.
I think
go on, Luca. Yeah.
Okay. Another thing to look at too, and this is something I've been discussing for quite a while with Colin, and he's been talking about publicly as well, is how on the other side of the ledger, essentially, so we're discussing CT approaches in terms of simultaneous focus on great power competition and counterterrorism, and how they can't really be separated. But what we're seeing also is that terrorist groups, insurgent groups, militant groups, they're learning organizations. And when we look at, for instance, their propaganda strategies, their operational strategies, they're quite public and overt about how they're looking at the shifts, the macro shifts in the global landscape, and adjusting their approaches and strategies in how they actually operate. So in with the Islamic State Central, with the Islamic State Khorasan province, and perhaps not far behind with the Islamic State in Somalia, they're actually beginning to focus and kind of distribute their hostile rhetoric onto China and Russia and the U.S. In a more kind of distributed fashion, whereas before they're mostly focusing on the U.S., but now we're seeing that they're talking about great power competition. I wrote an article with Colin for Foreign Policy, and we looked at how the Islamic State Khorasan province was talking about the Ukraine war and how they could capitalize on this. And then about a year later, we saw the Moscow attack. And it appears, according to the rhetoric leading up to this and afterwards, that they were looking at Russia being overstretched in Ukraine. With its private military activities in across Africa, its involvement in Syria. And they said there are gaps in intelligence, law enforcement, security coverage that we are going to exploit. And it looks like that's what they did. So we could actually see a similar strategy develop aimed at the United States, for instance. And we're increasingly seeing the Islamic State and Baloch groups in Pakistan, for instance, target Chinese interests, Chinese nationals, commercial interests. So on the other side of things, from the militant point of view, they're actually adapting their strategies quickly, and they're keeping an eye on all the news developments, the geopolitical developments, and so on. So this is very important as well, and something we need to keep an eye on and be cognizant of.
I agree with you. I've seen that in the Sahel, where the Russian group, I think they call the Bear Group now, or the African call, where I think it was in Burkina Faso, where they came under the strong heat attack from the, they lost about a significant number of some of the Russian machineries that were then recalled back to Russia.
Can I a brief comment on Wagner? Just it's a group that I've been following closely in.
Okay, go on.
Actually, I have a book coming out with Chris Faulkner and Raphael Parents.
So, oh, I know Chris Faulkner. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Through Columbia University Press this year. But my sense on Wagner, looking at Wagner specifically in the Sahel, it's another area where great competition is happening, and the U.S. is largely absent. And, you know, Wagner goes in and they're coup-proofing these various junta regimes. They're conducting scorched earth, you know, very heavy-handed counterinsurgency. And as you know, they're actually exacerbating and making the terrorism problem worse. If you look at some of the data, the Sahel is the most terrorism-prone region in the world, just by the numbers, pure quantity of terrorist attacks. And so at the end of the day, with no U.S. presence, no French presence, and a Russian PMC running around, that problem's getting worse, not better. The U.S. presence is getting pushed further toward the African littoral, the West Coast, and places like Ivory Coast and Benin and elsewhere. But who's going to clean up that mess? I mean, you know, and also I think there's really a lack of understanding, particularly in the West, of what's happening there. Even when you read in fairly mainstream news outlets, everybody's painted with a broad brush, right? These are terrorists or jihadists. When you dig down, some of these conflicts are pastoral, agrarian, clan-based, ethnic. They're not actually related to global jihad whatsoever. So I think, you know, without a greater understanding of that, we're really at a loss when it comes to operating in that part of the world.
I agree with Lucas that these groups are becoming more adept at even studying this geopolitical and taking advantage of all of these local grievances, like you've mentioned. You know, it could be the headers movement or the pastoralists, and they're manipulating that, exploiting that for their own advantage. But since we're talking about the Sahel, we've seen in the past where, like, Islam is taking the greater side, or Boko Haram, where, you know, which I really study, we've seen some speculations of linkages between them and Al-Shabaab in Somalia, or stuff in Somalia. So we have an ISIS proxy in Nigeria and the Lake Chad, ISWAP. Do you see any kind of collaboration where which ISIS Somalia might take advantage of the problem in the Sahel? Look at do you see the, or maybe since Colin, you're writing a book on it, maybe you might be able to speak on this.
I defer to Lucas on the Somalia.
Oh, okay, Lucas.
Yeah, well, IS in Somalia is particularly plugged in to transnational branches and other conflict theaters. It's been tasked by IS central leadership to oversee kind of regional, somewhat cross-continental operations. So this includes financing, sending trainers, sending foreign fighters, and kind of listening to and the needs of these groups, giving advice to them. Now, IS Somalia, its authority doesn't exactly reach into the Sahel, but the proximity of these conflicts, the transnational networks that exist, for instance, instability development or conflict developments, these happen fast, and if these groups see opportunity, they're given oxygen to kind of expand their interlinkages to provide mutual benefit, or they're directed to by IS central leadership. IS Somalia is very capable in this sense. It's not a strong insurgent, it doesn't have a strong insurgent capacity, but it's very good at the logistical, the strategic, the propaganda, the financial aspects of it. So there is a, you know, possibility that they could increase involvement further into the continent. So it is something to watch, and makes this IS branch of a specific concern when we look at African branches, even though it's militant kind of insurgent capacity isn't very strong. Its kind of strategic reach and influence and experience is.
Yeah, good. Colin, there's not much details about the kind of damage that this recent strike had on IS Somalia. Do you have any insights into the level of damage it have, or what impact it could have on this group operation.
It's hard to say. This wasn't the top, leader of IS in Somalia. It was a high ranking individual. Look, this gets back to the whole kind of cliche of whack-a-mole, what difference does it make if you're kind of conducting these pinprick strikes and taking out leadership when the group is really focused on kind of the next man up? I think Lucas made an important point, though, that I want to hone in on a little bit, which is, that IS Somalia doesn't have this impressive kind of insurgent capability. And this is where a lot of times folks will use the terms insurgency and terrorism interchangeably. But insurgency is really more about a long-term strategy to take over the government. And IS Somalia is really kind of almost operating in more in that pure terrorism mode, right? Where they're enabling attacks elsewhere. They're helping kind of play that logistical or functional role. And they're kind of lying in wait, biding their time. And so I think that's a really important distinction at the moment. And it's going to be interesting to see, to the extent that the Trump administration puts out a formal counterterrorism strategy, how they explain that strike and kind of, is that married to a broader strategy? Or are we kind of relying on tactics again? I really would like to see a kind of lay down or explanation about what's the plan, right, in that part of the world. Especially if there's going to be a troop withdrawal, is this kind of a further argument for what we call over the horizon counterterrorism? And I don't expect the administration to use that term, mostly because it's closely associated with the Biden administration, and anything that, the Biden administration talked about, Trump is keen to move away from or frame differently. But that's essentially what it would be without any kind of ground presence there. Right, is relying on ISR signals intelligence to kind of go after targets. So that's something that I'm hoping to see at some point in the administration's tenure is what does the strategy look like? How are they thinking about this? How are they approaching counterterrorism?
So we've seen in the, I think, are we returning to what we see under the Obama administration, where we see a lot of use of drone strike targeting these terrorist leaders? And we've also been seeing in the last couple of years withdrawal of troops like Commission in Afghanistan. We've seen, I think during Trump's first stop, we see withdrawal from Somalia. We've seen from other places. So is this sort of give us a glimpse into what strategy might be? Maybe it's going to be like more technology, drone strikes, light military footprints, or troops on the ground kind of a thing. Do you think that's the case here?
Again, I always say this, that Trump is the most difficult person to predict what he's going to do, because this is somebody that's largely talked about withdrawing from the Middle East, and then he turns around a couple of days ago and says the U.S. is going to own Gaza and potentially could do it with a U.S. military deployment. So figuring Trump out, good luck. One day it's one thing, the next it's the total 180 degree opposite. So, and again, that's why I went back to some kind of guiding document. Will the administration put out a formal strategy? I think it should. Or is this going to be an adhocracy where it's foreign policy through social media posts? I lived through that once. I'd really prefer not to do it again, where policy is made on the back end in response to whatever he tweeted out or talked about that day. I'm hoping to see more discipline this time around because, look, the world is a dangerous place. We need to take the foreign policy process seriously and not something that just we're kind of throwing darts and seeing where they land.
Okay, brilliant. So let's come to the because I'm aware of time. Let's come to the end of this. I'm going to give each one of you like some few minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, to talk about in the long term, how do you see the Islamic State activity shaping out in Somalia and Africa at large, and how do you see the US and other kind of allies responding to that, and what ramifications can we predict as well? So Lucas, if you want to go first.
Yeah, so one comparison I've been making carefully, I watched the kind of rise as did Colin. Colin's done great work, and he was one of the earliest analysts to warn about this trend. And this is something that's making us uneasy when we look at IS Somali also, is if we look at the Afghanistan-Pakistan branch, for instance, we saw that it was primarily, it was involved in some international terrorist operations, incidents, had some networks abroad, but it was largely and primarily regionally focused. But then we saw some shifts, for instance, in its rhetoric, in its regional targeting of international interests, of foreign nationals, diplomatic targets from foreign countries. These were kind of, this set off the alarm. These were red flags as to there's a transformation underway, and this deserves our attention and our understanding. So Colin, Ricardo Valle, Aaron Zellin, and a few others, we really dove into this, and it caused some concern. And now, as we've seen, the Islamic State Khorasan province has built up an extensive transnational propaganda apparatus, publishing propaganda in more languages than any other branch since the height of the caliphate. And they're conducting serious external operations abroad. So there are some similarities we're seeing, mostly over the last 3 years, with the IS Somalia branch in terms of its international outreach, its expanded external operations linkages in Sweden, in North America, throughout Europe. It's kind of propaganda expansion in terms of supporting kind of semi-official, unofficial outlets on the internet across many platforms, messaging applications, and so on, in terms of outreach, building international support, kind of reaching out and guiding operatives abroad. So we're seeing a lot of these kind of red flags, warning signs. We can't say that it's going to play out exactly as it has with ISKP in Afghanistan, Pakistan, but that should provide a kind of template for us to look at and, you know, be vigilant and pay attention to what we're seeing with IS Somalia as it becomes a global hub for kind of operations, for financing, for sending trainers around. Early in the year, for instance, in December or in January, we saw that the Islamic State was kind of showing off in video, in its through its official propaganda, the foreign fighters in its ranks. And we've been seeing alarming reports about the kind of drastic growth of foreign fighters within its ranks. And so these are all warning signs and things we should pay careful attention to. And it's why this branch in particular has kind of drawn my attention and concern, essentially.
Oh, thanks. I'm calling from the corner.
Yeah, look, I mean, I have a lot of concerns about Islamic State and growth in Africa. Our colleague Wasim Nasser has reported on this extensively and has done some really excellent work. But if you just look around sub-Saharan Africa itself, right, you have ISWAP, you know, Islamic State Sahel province or Greater Sahara, ISGS, right, whichever you want to call them. You have IS in Mozambique, IS in the DRC. You have activities connected to South Africa, IS in Somalia. And that's to say nothing of the Al-Qaeda groups on the continent like Shabab, JNIM, you know, whatever remnants of AQIM are running around in parts of North Africa, Algeria, elsewhere. So this is a kind of perfect storm of militant groups with very few, you know, competent military and security forces combating them. And then you have instances, and I've written about this in the past with Jacob Zen, where there's sometimes kind of a temporary detente or almost quasi-cooperation between certain groups, mostly competition, but that also drives the groups to innovate and to learn, engage in learning, which Lucas referenced. I think to me, the big piece here, and when I talk to folks in Washington and in the U.S. government or even our European partners about concerns, they say, well, you know, this is largely an African problem. These aren't focused on external operations. And I would push back again there and say it's not a Western problem until it is. Moreover, as we saw with the Kenyan Al-Shabaab operative who was arrested in the Philippines attempting to take flight training in an effort to replicate a 9/11 style attack, ex-ops are not completely off the table. This is something that I would be very concerned about. And moreover, Lucas referenced this. There's foreign fighters that are flooding into these groups. They already possess a transnational capability. He referenced some of Shabab's extraterritorial activities. I'd add to those the attack in Kampala back in maybe, was it 2010, surrounding the World
Cup? Yeah, 2010.
So, like, these are regional issues, and to me, they're transnational ones as well, especially when, you know, go back to my kind of key theme here, not to be overwrought on this, but we're not putting the appropriate level of resources against the threat level. And when you marry capability and intent, which some of these groups are really demonstrating, that's when we run into to serious counterterrorism issues.
Well, it does look bleak, but you know, I don't think it does look bleak. But hopefully, those that will take note of this will definitely, you know, take note of this so that we don't have a repeat of what we had in the past. Because from every indication, it does seem, and I've always seen this. We've seen this. I've forgotten the name of the author now. Where I think it was Jason Warner. I think we had Jason Warner a couple of episodes ago. Excellent work that you did there. So yes, I hope they will listen and we'll be able to prevent some of catastrophic terrorism that we've had in the past. But anyways, thank you, gentlemen, for your time and your very rich insights into the subject. I really, really appreciate it. I'll keep you posted once this is aired.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And enjoy the code, Lucas. All right, Collins.
Cheers.
You take care of yourself for now. Bye. Thank you for tuning in this week. Join me as usual to thank our guests, Professor Colin Clark and Lucas Weber, for their time, effort, and rich insights into this very special topic, the recent attack against ISIS Somalia and what Trump's counterterrorism policy in Africa will be. From 2.0. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.